Hey, Sparkles, you're listening to the Friendly Confines podcast with Chad and Ryan. This is David Kaplan from ESPN 1000 in Chicago and NBC Sports Chicago. Take that.
Chad, another special edition and another great guest. We have our second Pulitzer Prize winning reporter on this show.
Ira Kurko from
the New York Times is joining us to talk about his beloved Chicago Cubs.
It's so crazy. When we started this, we didn't know. Like, we had hopes, right? I mean, when we started this, we thought we want to have conversations with cool people. And we had, like, big, crazy guests. But the fact that we've had two Pulitzer Prize winners is just stupid nutty. It's ridiculous that we get that. I love it. No other Cubs podcast gets better guests. And we're unaffiliated. It's not like the Cubs are pulling these guys in for us or the marketing network. We're doing this because they've heard of us, they know about us, and they respect us. I'm hoping that's why, right?
I would like to think so. It's also our charm, I think, is part of it as well. So, without any further ado, here is our full interview with former New York Times sports reporter Ira Kurko. You grew up in Chicago. You're a city boy at heart before you once upon a time started your sports reporting career. Give me your first memories of going to a Cubs game in Wrigley Field and seeing it for the first time. If you can paint a picture for me, what that was like for you and how you became a Cubs fan.
Well, the first time I went to Wrigley Field, as I can remember, I went with a couple guys from the West Side neighborhood, and the most striking thing, and it's memorable forever to me, is when I walked up the stairs from the inner area of Wrigley Field, where they were selling the hot dogs and the scorecards. And I walked up, and I was struck by the green of the ballpark of the field, and it was just one of the most beautiful scenes I think I've ever seen. And you fall in love with Wrigley Field. I think one has to. And as a sports writer and a sports columnist for over 50 years, and I've been to just about every major league park. And still, the one that stands out is Wrigley Field. And I remember a handful of years ago, I had a friend who was a doctor for the Yankees. And the Yankees were going to play the Cubs for the first time since 1938 or something, and at Wrigley Field. And so he, his name was Dr. Hershon, Stuart Hershon, and he accompanied the Yankees to Chicago. And I said to him, you're really going to be surprised at how beautiful Wrigley Field is. And he said, it's like the oldest ballpark in America. I mean, how beautiful, you know, can it be? How much can I be taken by it? And so he went there, and somewhere like in the third or fourth inning, I got a call from him to me in New York, and he said, Ira, you underestimated Wrigley Field for me, that it was absolutely gorgeous and memorable. And he said, and I've never been in a sports venue that has the charisma that Wrigley Field does. And retains.
This must have been before you wrote your book, Ira. Otherwise, he should have read it, and then maybe it would have given him a better impression of what he was walking into, I suppose.
Yeah, no, it was. I mean, if you look back, the first time the Yankees played at Wrigley Field, it was in the 21st century, 2002, 2004. I don't remember, or maybe even earlier. But whatever it was, that was... He was taken aback by it, and everybody who goes to Wrigley Field is, unless you're in the grandstands and you sit behind one of the pillars, then you don't have the same kind of a pleasure of watching the ball game. You have to strain your neck right, and you have to strain your neck left to see first base or to see left field.
You wrote a wonderful book. It's called Wrigley Field, an Oral and Narrative History of the Home of the Chicago Cubs, one of many books you have written over your career. Let's make sure people know that. You wrote this in 2014. What prompted you to write the book and decide to create this coffee table book about Wrigley and the Cubs?
Yeah, my agent David Black was talking to the an editor at Abrams, which makes the most gorgeous art books. And he had said that coming up, you know, Wrigley Field had been featured in like magazines like Architectural Digest. I mean, it goes just beyond just the ballpark, and also, you know, the history of it is also is prominent. And he just happened to mention that I'm from Chicago, and I've been a lifelong Cub fan, and at the time I was writing Sports of the Times column for the New York Times, and she said, my agent, the male David, said to this editor, was a woman, that would make a very a beautiful book of Wrigley Field on the 100th anniversary of the Cubs in the ballpark, and so they came to me and they made me an offer, and it was, like the tough guys. It was an offer I couldn't refuse.
That's right.
And so I went about it, and then I, among other things, I hired a young writer from the Chicago Tribune, whose family I was friends with for years, and his name was Josh Noel. He's a reporter for the Chicago Tribune. And so I hired him to do interviews, and I would write the text, but I also I wanted to get Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens to write an introduction, because he's from Chicago and he is a lifelong Cub fan, going all the way back to when he was, I think, 12 years old, and his father took him to the 1932 World Series, and he was at the third game of the series when Babe Ruth, you know, allegedly pointed to center field and called his shot. It's controversial about whether he was actually calling the shot that he's going to hit a home run into the center field bleachers, but he did. Justice Stevens wrote the introduction for the book, and I was thrilled with that. And then and Josh was friendly with Kerry Wood, who, the Cubs pitcher, and he asked him to write the foreword. And so we had these two distinguished individuals, American personalities, Kerry Wood and Justice John Paul Stevens, writing the foreword and the introduction. And I think that gave a certain gravitas to the book, and with great photographs. And it's I'd have to say, objectively speaking, and I don't know if you would agree or not, but it's a glorious book.
Oh, it absolutely is. And I also want to make sure people know that you interviewed several people for the book, including President Barack Obama, Joe Mantegna, and friend of the program and fellow Pulitzer Prize winning author George Will. I'm curious, over the course of those interviews, did you learn anything in the time that you did interviews about the team, about Wrigley, about the city? that dawned on you from interviewing these obviously highly accomplished and legendary people in some of these folks that you got the chance to talk to in making the book?
Well, the fact is, I don't think I necessarily learned anything from them other than somebody like Justice Stevens, you know, who was at that historic game with Babe Ruth and was following it. There used to be the Stevens Hotel in Chicago. It's now the Hilton. And John Paul Stevens' family owned that hotel. It was a huge hotel. I think it was greatest number of rooms of any hotel in America at one point. And so his father was a prominent man in Chicago, and he brought his 12-year-old son, John Paul Stevens, to the ball game. But other than that, you know, I grew up going to the ballpark, hanging around to get autographs for the from the players, following them for all these years. You know, off the top of my head, I'm not sure I learned anything more. Of course, you always learn something. You always learn something. But I do know that in some of the interviews, I traded memories with some of these people, and so that was my initiation into the early part of my Cub fandom.
What was your takeaway when you interviewed the president for that book? Because President Obama has always stated he's a White Sox fan. Yeah. What was his relationship like with the Cubs and Wrigley when you interviewed him for the book?
Yeah. Well, that was funny because a Chicago friend of mine, a former state senator named Bill Maravitz, was friends with Obama. And in fact, Bill lives on Lakeshore Drive in a duplex. And when Obama was starting to run for the presidency, Bill gave a big party for him, a fundraiser. And Bill was also friends with Reinsdorf, the owner of the White Sox, of course. And the White Sox were going to play Washington, and Strasburg then was the outstanding young pitcher for the Washington Nationals. And so Reinsdorf invited Bill and me to come up. Bill was in New York with me and visiting me. And then we went down to Washington. And just before the game, a tall or lean black man wearing a White Sox cap came in, and it was then the President of the United States. This was 2010, and so we chatted, and I had known that he had said that he was a White Sox fan, and so and I asked him, what are your thoughts on the Cubs? Now, as you know, there's a great rivalry split by Madison Avenue or Madison Street in Chicago. And south of Madison, White Sox fans north of Madison are Cub fans. And there's a certain hostility. And, yes. And Obama maintained that hostility as a White Sox fan. And he said, and I asked him about the Cubs, and he said, look, I was on a radio show maybe a year earlier, and someone asked me about the Cubs, and I was not complimentary, and I got a lot of feedback on it. And so I'd just rather not comment on the Cubs because it gets me into too much trouble.
Well, who can forget also when the Cubs won the World Series and they came to the White House, and I don't think I've ever seen the White House filled the capacity for a team visiting. And President Obama did make the comment that his wife, Michelle, obviously was extremely excited because she was a Cubs fan. So he has to be a little bit, partial, I suppose, or bipartial in this respect, knowing that in his family, it's right down the middle, I suppose, for them.
Yeah, well it's odd that Michelle, being a Southsider, would be a Cub fan. I mean, maybe she took to Ernie Banks or something, in the beginning. Just as when I was growing up in the late 40s, I took to Andy Pafko, the Cubs center fielder at the time. I don't know if I'm sure Obama was proud that it was a Chicago team that won, because he is so associated now with Chicago. And so the Cubs win the World Series, and he had to take some pride, I think, in this, especially since, although he was from Hawaii, Honolulu does not have a Major League Baseball team.
It's time for the Golden Cubs Fun Fact of the Week, brought to you by our partners at Golden Rule Entertainment. Did you know that the Chicago Cubs have won 17 pennants in the history of the franchise? The first coming in 1876, and the most recent, of course, in 2016. The Cubs were one of the most dominant franchises in baseball, winning 5 pennants in 7 seasons between 1880 and 1886, and then 4 pennants in 5 seasons between 1906 and 1910, including 2 World Series titles. That's your Golden Cubs Fun Fact of the Week, brought to you by Golden Rule Entertainment, offering big league opportunities while owning a piece of a minor league style ball club. To find out more information about how you can become an owner, go to www.goldenruleentertainment.com. And now back to our interview with Ira Burko.
Of course, I want to make sure I plug the book again, Wrigley Field, An Oral and Narrative History of the Home of the Chicago Cubs, written in 2014, but still an amazing book. If you are a diehard Cubs fan, and you can buy that on Amazon or other online sites or at bookstores that are locally near you. Ira, I'm curious how you consumed Game 7 of the 2016 World Series and what that night and event was for you. And did it at all prompt you to write, not even necessarily something for the Times, but just something personally that maybe you held on to or you kept that you still, hold on to that is personal to you?
Yeah. I went to Wrigley. I went to see the first two games at Wrigley Field, games 3 and 4. And then I came back home, and of course I watched game 5, game 6. And then a friend of mine, a very good friend of mine said, Ira, I'd like to come over and watch game 7 with you. I said, I don't think it's a good idea, because I'm going to have total concentration on the game, and I wouldn't want any conversations to distract me from watching the game. He said, Ira, I promise I'll come over. I just want to experience it with you. I want to come over, and I won't say a word. And so he came over. I opened the door. I looked at him, did not say hello. He came in. He sat down. We saw a little pregame, and then the game came on. And he didn't say a word for 3 hours or whatever it was. It was a rainout, and I was concentrating, so that solidified my friendship with him.
He was always able to watch a game with you, no matter what. At that point,
yeah, he wanted to. He's a psychiatrist, and we used to play basketball. We met playing basketball, and I've never sat on his couch or lay on his couch. But we're friends. Our wives are friends and so on. So, I mean, he happens to be a psychiatrist. Okay. And so he said, I'd just like to come over and just experience this with you, because he knows I'm such a Cub fan. And, so that was our experience. And, he's never forgotten it, and he's ever offer to come back and watch a game with me.
Well, I think he hit the pinnacle at that point, right? I mean, to see it at that moment, you were about 76 years old at that point, to see it finally come to fruition. Yeah. How did you kind of manifest that at that point when it finally happened?
It brought me to tears, really. I mean, I've been following the team since I was, 7 years old, 8 years old, 1947, 1948. And I've been following them all these years. And even when I became a journalist and sitting in the press box, there's a saying, no cheering in the press box, because we're all professionals and we're all covering these games objectively as we would cover a crime scene or something. And so you have to be objective and there's no cheering in the press box. On the other hand, when I would go to Shea Stadium, or when I traveled to Wrigley Field, and I was sat in the press box, if the Cubs did something special, I very quietly under the desk applauded.
You just never let Jay Horowitz see that.
Jay Horowitz, right?
Never wanted to make sure Jay saw that. Very, very cool. Very cool. Let me ask you this. You've clearly covered a lot of baseball in your career. Yeah. Are you happy with the way the game looks today? Do you, when you watch it, is the game better? Is it worse? It's certainly different. I think that's safe to say. But how do you view today's game of baseball comparatively to even 30 years ago, let's say?
Yeah. All right. I'll get back to the interview. You had asked me another question about it. Had I written anything about the Cubs in the World Series?
Yes, absolutely.
And I did. And I wrote it for a national press. I was now retired from the New York Times, but I wrote it for a national press organization. And I had wrote two pieces. One before the World Series, and then after the World Series, and they were included in a collection of my baseball pieces called "It Happens Every Spring," and that was published maybe 2-3 years ago. But both those pieces are in it. But you asked me, okay, so now we're going to go back. I just looked this morning. The Cubs played
Milwaukee,
and they won 3-2. And so I just want to see the. I went to Google and went and got the box score. And I saw in a 3-2 game that the Cubs had, I think, six pitchers?
Yes.
They had six pitchers in a 3-2 game. I saw the starting pitcher, what was his name?
I don't remember. Adzelay. Now.
What is it?
Albert Adzelay?
Yeah, yeah. He pitched the first four innings. He gave up two runs in the second inning, and then he pitched a shutout third inning, shutout fourth inning, and then he was removed. Why? You know, I mean, that's all I know about the game is what I saw in the box score. Here comes a parade of pitchers coming in. Who wants to see that? You know, I mean, I was surprised. I saw the San Diego. What a lovely story about this pitcher who I'd never heard of before, Joe Musgrove. Mm-hmm. And he pitched he's with San Diego Padres now, and he was with Diego, and he pitched a no-hitter in San Diego. And here was a high school. He played high school ball in San Diego, and a hometown boy. I mean, what a beautiful story. And his parents own a coffee shop in San Diego, so they're doing a big business now. All the San Diego people are coming in and getting coffee in this coffee shop. But my point here is that he wasn't taken out after four innings or five innings, and now he's pitching a no hitter. He actually hit a batter, and so that was the only runner to get on base. So it was not a perfect game. But the manager kept them in. There have been instances in the last few years where a guy is pitching a no-hitter into the seventh inning or so, and the manager takes him out. And so, to me, this isn't baseball. I mean, this is, you know, how do you follow this kind of thing? On the other hand, if you go to my book on Wrigley Field, and I don't have the book in front of me, but I think it's page 21, and there's a picture of four Sullivan High School baseball players, a photograph of them taken in 1955. And one of the players is an outfielder, sophomore outfielder named Ira Burko. Okay. So, the reason I say this is because I've been following it for so long, and I appreciate it. I played 4 years of high school baseball. I played American Legion and Pony League and all that, and Liberty League. And I go to games now, and I watch the beauty of baseball. Deep into the hole at short, turning and throwing that long throw across the infield. Go onto a baseball field sometime and look and see how far, how long that throw is. It's a long throw. And often at a play like that, they get the guy out by a half a step. I mean, this is, it's just beautiful. And so the and a skill and the talent and these guys are just so good. I grew up in grammar school and played on a Pony League team on the west side of Chicago with a guy named Jimmy Nelson. Jimmy was a shortstop, and he was an all-city player. I went to Farragut High School, and then he went to Northwestern, and he made all Big Ten as a shortstop. He was a terrific player, obviously, and we're still very, very good friends. He lives in South Carolina now, and then he was signed by the Minnesota Twins, and he played 1 year professional ball in a minor league farm team for the Twins, and he had only a mediocre season. He may have batted 220 or so, and he played a number of games. And then they released him after the season. And it was sometime after, then he became a principal in a suburban Chicago school, a junior high school. And I went to visit him. And I said, Jimmy, what happened? I mean, you're such a good player. And yet you were cut. And he said, Ira, you can't imagine how good these guys are. The 25th player on a major league team is an outstanding baseball player. And I've never been able to boo sports athletes. I've never been able to boo them unless they do something really, really stupid in a game, mostly of basketball, sometimes football, but not so much even in baseball, because baseball is harder than I think almost any other sport overall. And so four guys now play for a left-handed batter. Four guys are playing on the right side of second base, for example. And then the batter does not try to hit it down the third baseline. And so these are things that change. Although Ted Williams wouldn't hit that way either when a shift on the first shift was 1996, I think. And the outfield and a high fly ball into the sky, and it's very difficult, but they make it all seem so easy. Of course, they practiced a lot, but still at all, it's hard. And the pitchers, you know, I was noticing a game yesterday, the Mets and the Phillies, and there was a pitcher for the Phillies, for the Mets named Stroman, and the catcher gives a signal and then sets up, and he has his catcher's mitt like at the knee on the inside of the plate to a right-handed batter, and that Stroman hits that mitt, and I think it's outstanding. I was a high school pitcher, and if the guy a target like that low and inside, somehow or other I'd always throw it high and outside. I don't know. I was terrific at this, I mean, the game is still beautiful. Probably the National League should also adopt the designated hitter. I was opposed to the designated hitter when it first started, but, you know, why should the pitcher who doesn't practice batting come up and none of them know how to bunt, even if a called for. They just don't practice. So those are some of the changes I see.
And our thanks once again to Ira Burko, formerly of the New York Times, Pulitzer Prize winning reporter, has such an amazing list of things that this man has accomplished. So it was really great to catch up with him. And of course, be sure to check out his book about Wrigley Field, the perfect complement to any coffee table, Chad.
Yeah.
Really a absolute cool book that I think if you're a Cub fan, you will definitely.
Yeah. Enjoy. I love the stories. I thought you did a great job on the interview. I've had some friends ask at times, you know, why do we team up on some interviews? Why do we go solo on others? And sometimes it just makes sense from a timing perspective because we get the people and we get them. But we had, who was it? Oh, Boog. I was ready to go. I was back home, tending to my mom dealing with COVID, and I couldn't do it because I had a bad connection from the hospital, and you did that. This will go down in our time. That's probably this week's, interview with Ira is probably the best one ever done because I produced it. I was there, but I produced it. I was running the board and behind the scenes. I think technically it was as good as any, interview ever done, but you obviously did a great job. I love the stories that came out of it. I love these stories. I love these guys that are at the top of their field, but at their heart, they're Cubs fans just like us.
Yeah, they really are. And I loved his story about President Obama. That was so cool that he got to interview Obama for the book along with Joe Mantegna and just, you know, talking to President Obama, who's obviously a very known Chicago White Sox fan, and kind of what that was like for him to deal with everything going on in this book with the Cubs. So that was pretty exciting. So,
and if you think about it, when he talked about it, I didn't mean to cut you off, Rhino, but when he talked about that book, he's like, you know, this guy's with the New York Times. And so his access to some of the some of the people, was just nutty. And so that was such a great story. So we love that you guys are listening. Make sure you check out our new website, theconfines.com. Follow us at the Friendly Confines Cubs Facebook page. Ryan is at Twitter at Ryan D. Lieber. I'm at the Chad Gordon. Rhino, another fun interview. I can't wait to see who else we get this season.
Oh, without a doubt. So with that will wrap things up on this special edition of the Friendly Confines. For Chad, I'm Ryan. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. Have a good one.
See you at the ballpark, everybody.
Don't let anyone say that it's just a game. For I've seen other teams and it's never the same. When you're born in Chicago, you're blessed and you're healed. The first time you walk into Wrigley.